From Pacifico Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. I am Malihe Razazan. This week, we bring you the first part of our conversation with UC Berkeley historian Professor Astorian about the military conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan, two former Soviet Union republics in the Caucasus region, and the role of regional players, including Iran, Israel, Turkey, and Russia. Stay with us. On September 27th, fighting erupted once more between Armenia and Azerbaijan, two former Soviet Union republics in the Caucasus region. At the heart of the decades-old conflict is Nagorno-Karabakh, a mountainous region of just 150,000 people. In 1991, when official dissolution of the Soviet Union began, the mostly Armenian inhabitants of Nagorno-Karabakh declared independence from Azerbaijan following a referendum that was boycotted by the region's Azeri population. The declaration sparked a war that led to the loss of 30,000 lives, the displacement of more than 1 million people, and reports of massacres committed by both sides. Most of those displaced in the war were Azerbaijanis. By 1994, when an internationally brokered ceasefire was declared, ethnic Armenians controlled almost all of Nagorno-Karabakh, plus seven surrounding Azeri districts that gave them a buffer zone and a corridor connecting the region to the Republic of Armenia. Since then, Nagorno-Karabakh, also known as Mountainous Karabakh, has been run as an independent entity with Armenian support but no international recognition. What are the root causes of Nagorno-Karabakh conflict? What explains this latest round of fighting between the two countries? What are the geopolitical and regional implications of the fighting and the role played by the regional actors, including Turkey, Russia, Iran, and Israel? Shahram Aghamir posed these questions to Stefan Astorian, the director of the Armenian Studies Program at UC Berkeley and professor of the politics and history of the Caucasus and Armenia.
So let me start with the situation on the ground, because there have been very significant changes over the past week, but especially over the past 24 hours. In 1993-94, after the war that started around 92 between the Nagorno-Karabakh Armenians and Azerbaijan, of course, it had started earlier, but it was more a kind of a guerrilla type of war, relatively low intensity. After 92, it became a real traditional type of war. And in that war, to the surprise of many, the Karabakh Armenians were able to defeat the then Azerbaijani army, which was much better equipped, because when the Soviet Union dissolved, you know, they divided the armaments among republics, and very clearly Azerbaijan had a lot of armaments. But they were defeated, and the Karabakh Armenians could move into some surrounding provinces, seven of them: Kubatlı, Zangilan, Jabrail, Fuzuli, Agdam, Lachin, and Kelbajar. This war has been going on for about, I would say, 32 days. It started on September the 27th. Right now, the Azerbaijani have reconquered Zangilan, Jabrail, Fuzuli, most of Kubatlı. And as of the past 2-3 days, they were advancing in the direction of Lachin, which is the corridor linking Armenia with mountainous Karabakh. Their advance yesterday was very clearly stalled, the day before also. And it would seem that last night they adopted a new strategy or tactical approach, or maybe it was planned all along, and they suddenly advanced from an area known as Hadrut toward Armenian Shusha in Azerbaijan, which is a symbolic city for Armenians and also for Azerbaijanis who view part of their culture as having originated in Shusha. According to the latest data, including data by people specialized in geolocation, intelligence people, and they have been also, actually it's the Armenian government that has corroborated all that. The latest news are that some of the Azerbaijani troops are around 5 kilometers away from Shusha or Shushi, not the bulk of the troops, but the forward elements. And some of the geolocation data by specialists, non-Armenian, non-Azerbaijani, suggests that over the last night, somehow the Azerbaijani troops could advance about 10, 11 kilometers from Hadrut in the direction of Shushi or Shusha. In a nutshell, at this point, the Karabakh Armenians are left with the Agdam province, with the Kelbajar Pass, which is endangered, and part of Lachin, even though over the past week and so on, the corridor of Lachin linking Armenia to Nagorno-Karabakh has been, we know, shelled. So this is where we stand now. Regarding the ceasefire, yes, there were three ceasefires. The first one brokered mainly by Russia, even though it was under the umbrella of the Minsk group co-chairs. The second one, France was quite active. Mr. Macron, the president, again, always Minsk group co-chairs. And then the third one, all of them have immediately failed for a very simple reason. Armenia wanted them, but for example, even the first one, Azerbaijan, after 11 hours of negotiation in Moscow, was reluctant to agree to the ceasefire. It opposed also over the past 6-7 years the installation of monitoring devices along the border to find out who is starting a conflict and so on. And I would argue also that it doesn't surprise me at all that they failed, because it's not at all in the interest of Turkey to stop this war now, especially now when the Azerbaijani cum Turkish forces have had some substantial success, are coming close to Shushi or Shusha, depending on what name you like, have been stopped near Lachin, but they are not too far. So why should they agree to a ceasefire? I believe Mr. Erdogan wants to go all the way. And in that sense, if there is a fourth ceasefire in the current conditions, I wouldn't be very optimistic about its survival, let's say.
The contradiction between the principle of territorial integrity and the principle of national self-determination is at the heart of the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict today. Both sides of the conflict, the Armenians as well as the Azeris, present narratives based on historical claims that sometimes date back hundreds, if not thousands of years. But it seems more reasonable to look at the rhetoric, policies and practices of different actors during the time that the Soviet Union existed, and specifically its final years, in order to identify the origins of this conflict. As a historian, how do you explain the roots of this dispute? How far back would you go?
You are absolutely right. We can go back to antiquity. And of course, I will be contradicted by my Azerbaijani colleagues. But that region, the mountainous part of Karabakh, because it has also plains, the mountainous part of Karabakh in late antiquity, early Middle Ages, was known as Artsakh and part of it Utik. These were Armenian provinces. I don't know the extent to which going back 20 centuries is useful to understand the current conflict. The current conflict, to understand it, you have to go to the beginning of the 20th century. Vast areas in the South Caucasus, the conquest of which was completed by the Russian Empire in 1828, were inhabited by mixed populations. This applies to areas like the district, the gubernia, the governorate of Elizavetpol, which is now Genji in Azerbaijan, and the area of Mountainous Karabakh was part of that governorate. Even Baku had mixed population, and the area of Yerevan, the capital of Armenia, got a clear Armenian majority population towards the end of the 19th century, even though, of course, Yerevan in antiquity and so on was an Armenian inhabited area, but it had been emptied of its population as a result of the Seljuk invasions, Mongol invasion, Turco-Mongol invasions of Timurlenk, and then the White Sheep, Black Sheep Confederation, the 15th century conflicts. So, in a nutshell, when you look at the area at the beginning of the 20th century, you don't have clear national borders. You have mixed populations, okay, in some areas very clearly the Georgians are in the majority, in other areas the South Caucasian Muslims, known as Tatars to the Russians, they would call themselves Musulman at that time, not Azerbaijanis, were in the majority. In some areas, Armenians were in the majority, but it was totally mixed. The first step started with a conflict during the Russian Revolution of 1905. It is usually referred to as the Armenian-Tatar War, and I actually lectured about it today to my class. It's a conflict that started in Baku in early 1905 and literally circulated throughout the Caucasus. Yerevan, Tiflis, Mountainous Karabakh, Elizavetpol, Nukha, Kazakh, Daralagya, Zangezur, and so all of the areas. This is the first conflict where you have pogroms and inter-ethnic clashes, very significant, between South Caucasian Muslims and Armenians. And again, you see the mixed population in those conflicts. It is during the first independent republics of Armenia, Azerbaijan, and Georgia, between 1918 and 20 for Armenia and Azerbaijan. Georgia was Sovietized in early 21. This is a period of already ethnic cleansing, of ethnic consolidation of the various republics. And insofar as Azerbaijan and Armenia are concerned, there are a few disputed regions. One of those disputed regions is Mountainous Karabakh. When Armenia was Sovietized on December the 2nd, 1920, or December 29th, if you are a communist, because you refer to a particular proclamation, so far as I remember, it's December the 1st, the leader of the Azerbaijani party is essentially Nariman Narimanov, and he recognizes that in a brotherly gesture, Karabakh belongs to Armenia. Stalin also does the same thing, and it looks as if the question of Karabakh at least is settled, and there remain Nakhichevan and Zangezur. In early June, assured by the Caucasian Bureau of the Communist Party that Karabakh would be Armenian, the Armenian communists even make an official statement that they are happy that Karabakh is Armenian. And then there is a meeting of the Caucasian Bureau of the Communist Party in early July. In that meeting on July the 4th, the very clear majority, including very significant person whose name was Orjonikidze, decide that Karabakh, Mountainous Karabakh, will be attached to Armenia. And then all that we know is that Stalin joins that meeting. And on July the 5th, that is almost the same day, on July the 5th, very early at night, the decision taken on July the 4th is basically reversed. And suddenly, Mountainous Karabakh is attached to the Azerbaijan. There are several interpretations, including interpretations I would call outright ridiculous, but they have been promoted lately, not just by Azerbaijanis, actually. There are some Western scholars. I think the valid interpretation, and I have documents about that, is that at that time the Bolsheviks were collaborating with the Kemalist Turks. They were entertaining dreams that the Kemalists can be brought to their side, even to convince them to get closer to Bolshevism. The goal was to counteract Western imperialism in the Middle East, particularly British imperialism and so on. So the attribution of, Mountainous Karabakh suddenly to Azerbaijan resulted from that calculation. There is a more traditional interpretation also of divide and rule, you know, that is, you put minorities as an enclave in a majority area to better able to control it. In Georgia, these were the Abkhazs, the South Ossetians, for example. And then you had the North Ossetia within the Russian Federation. Some scholars now, most of them coming from the past Marxist positions, doubt that, talk about pragmatic moves. There is a young scholar who even wrote something to the effect that Karabakh was given to the Azerbaijanis because there were better roads with Azerbaijan and there were shepherds, Azeri shepherds and things like that. If somebody believes that Stalin was particularly interested in Azeri shepherds, I'm afraid that's a new dimension in the field of history, you know. It was attributed for very clear political reasons, and that started the problems. There were Armenian complaints. They had to shut up when Stalin became the supreme and only leader of the Soviet Union after 1928 until his death in 1953. And then complaints again emerged in the 60s and increased in the 70s and 80s. And in the 80s, with the process of glasnost, you know, openness, perestroika, restructuring under Gorbachev, suddenly the opportunity of talking became greater. And Karabakh Armenians started demonstrating. They were backed by some Armenians in Armenia, asking the Soviet Union to solve this issue. And here we are reaching the point you are mentioning. In the Soviet Constitution, there were two clauses. You could ask for separation from a republic, but then that was permitted. There was a clause in the Constitution about that. But another clause mentioned that both of the republics had to agree. That is, in this case, let's say Karabakh Armenians want to join Armenia. Okay, that's constitutional. But to do so, both the Soviet Socialist Republic of Armenia and of Azerbaijan have to agree. In a nutshell, the constitution was set up in such a way that secession, let's say, was quasi-impossible, even though we know that during the Soviet period, and mostly after the Second World War, 15 areas changed positions. By positions, I mean, let me tell you the best example because it is very relevant to the present. Crimea was transferred to Ukraine by Khrushchev in the 1950s. Earlier than that, it wasn't part of the Ukraine. And as you know, a few years ago, the Russians moved into Crimea and so on, and there was a huge uproar in the West. But this is one example, for example, of a large region transferred, and there was no problem at all. So my impression about international law is that when there is a will and when there is power, there is a path. And here I am going to move to not Soviet law, but international law. The example that comes to mind is that of Kosovo. NATO, you know, allowed them a particular status with an assembly. It wasn't independence. The Kosovo assembly voted for independence, and suddenly, one after another, Western powers recognized the independence. That had nothing to do with international law, but it was in the interest of the so-called, elegantly called international community, that is the West. Well, Karabakh did that in the early 1990s in a totally democratic way, but nobody has recognized Karabakh so far, by the way, including Armenia, for political, probably diplomatic, military reasons. And you are right, the two principles of territorial integrity, of course, stressed by Azerbaijan, and self-determination, stressed by Armenia and the Karabakh Armenians, are conflictual principles. The predominance so far has been territorial integrity, with most cases in favor of self-determination having been applied to colonial situation, you know, to decolonization. But there is also a lot of flexibility. There is no pure international law without power relations. And when Abkhazia and South Ossetia proclaimed independence after the Russo-Georgian War and the Georgian-South Ossetian War of 2008, Russia recognized them, and I believe a few other countries, even though one of them is totally unviable. I mean, I'm thinking of South Ossetia. So in a nutshell, one shouldn't fall either into the trap of a fetishism of international law. It would seem that international law can be used in accordance to existing power relations.
I just want to go back a bit to that Soviet period again. One of the arguments that has been put forward with respect to the way the boundaries were delineated in Caucasus is that Joseph Stalin's policy in Caucasus in particular was to delineate boundaries that would divide the people and prevent unified resistance. They were designed to cause dissent in the regions and allow the center, that is Russia, to control them. As a historian, you see that in some of the boundaries that were created by former colonialists when they left these regions.
Exactly. Some of them, Africa, for example, with large tribes divided between two states. I personally do agree, even though I know that there has been a trend over the past 10, 12 years of a new breed of historians who deny that. I don't find their position convincing at all. And I think Stalin, I am not revealing anything, was quite a Machiavellian character, you know. He did that in the Politburo, using one side against the other and then killing both before seizing power in 1928. And he was, as you know, deeply knowledgeable about the situation in the Caucasus. He was himself from Georgia. I believe he spent some time in Baku in the early 20th century.
Yes,
the area was very well known to him. I know some people will disagree, but I am here to share my opinion, and I fully agree with that interpretation.
It seems odd that you have the Armenian Republic and Nagorno-Karabakh separated. And similarly, the Azeris were divided into Azerbaijani Republic and Nakhchivan. It seems like they could have created boundaries that cleared connectivity between these two regions, right?
First, let me tell you why these arrangements. I mean, these new historians, and one of them is an older person, they can say whatever they want. 40 years ago, a few of them had even doubts about the Armenian genocide. So, you know, I don't care. When mountainous Karabakh, not Karabakh as a whole, the plains of Karabakh that are larger than mountainous Karabakh have always been predominantly inhabited by Muslim populations. And at the beginning of the 20th century, a lot of those populations were made up of pastoral nomads. So we are not talking about Karabakh as a whole. The plains are very clearly with a Muslim population and a majority there. When mountainous Karabakh suddenly was, Stalin took the decision to Sovietize it, and by 1923, particular status was given of autonomous oblast, region, and so on, the population was more than 90% Armenian. I have collected maps of the area from the 1920s, Russian and Soviet maps, not Armenian or anything like that, to about 1936. And it turns out that when Karabakh was given to Armenia, and in the most of the 1920s, It was actually attached to Armenia. It had territorial contiguity in a place called Der, which I believe, by the way, is the birthplace of the second president of Armenia, Serge Sarkisian. And then slowly you see that they cut Karabakh from Armenia. That seems to coincide with a moment when some kind of a Kurdish republic was created, very short-lived in that area. And by the mid-30s, Karabakh is cut from Armenia territory. And the point you were making about Nakhichevan, which is very bizarre. In Nakhichevan, before the First World War, Muslims were in the majority. Armenians were a little bit above 40% of the population, so far as I remember. After the First World War, there were about 15-16% Armenians left. There were pogroms and so on. Fine. But Nakhichevan was attributed to Azerbaijan, even though it's an exclave of Azerbaijan. That is, it has no territorial contiguity whatsoever, which makes the arrangement extremely unusual. And with the Treaty of Kars, Moscow and Kars of 1921, a small piece of land was given to attach Nakhichevan to Kemalist Turkey. So Nakhichevan today is a very dangerous place for the future. Iran has amassed significant troops around there. Nakhichevan has been essentially Turkified over the past decade. And if there is something wrong in that area, I believe it's most likely probably the only place where things can outright degenerate, you know, regionally.
Some political analysts and politicians had characterized the mountainous Karabakh conflict as a frozen conflict because a tenuous ceasefire had held since 1994. It mostly prevailed since then, except for a four-day war in 2016 and a flare-up last July. This image of quote-unquote frozen conflict was shattered when the current round of fighting broke out on the 27th of September. What sparked these clashes and why now?
First, we are living in an age where reality is fading away behind theater. It's like a little bit the metaphor of the cave. We see the shadows, we don't see the reality behind our back. So we are being offered some alternative reality, among other things, by the media, politicians, and so on. Frozen conflict. What does frozen conflict mean? It means nothing. It's as if I am a doctor, and I tell a patient, I have good news for you. You have frozen cancer. Yeah? It's perfect. You know, it will last as long as it lasts, but it's frozen. There is no frozen conflict. It's delayed conflict. It's latent conflict.
It's simmering.
Submerged conflict.
Yes.
It's not frozen. And as a matter of fact, it melted. There is another theme that I got sick of it, actually, over the past years. The idea that this Karabakh issue is only a diplomatic solution. Oh, no, there is only a diplomatic solution. Okay. Well, as a matter of fact, right now, right in front of our eyes, if the Azerbaijanis capture Shushi or Shusha over the next few days, or if they can start advancing again into the Lachin corridor, the conflict will have had a military solution. What diplomatic solution? So, with all due respect, nonsense is proliferating with think tanks very well paid by various companies, countries, associations. I have looked at the way news is produced or analysis is presented, and there is a very important article that was published recently, in particular about Azerbaijan. It's fascinating how much money has been spread to shape interpretation, the news, opinions, and so on. So, to me, these ideas are fake ideas.
What sparked these clashes? Why now?
You see, there are several factors. I think probably the most crucial factor, I cannot prove it with solid evidence, but that's my sense. Since 2014, approximately, Azerbaijan has easily bought more than $12 billion in armament, including very advanced modern armaments. It is, I believe, at the apex of its comparative advantage in a military sense with relation to Armenia. That's one of the reasons. The second reason is that the negotiations have reached a total deadlock. Over the past 2-3 years, President Aliyev, probably thinking that the newly elected Prime Minister of Armenia, Nikol Pashinyan, is inexperienced and so on, has adopted a maximalist position, saying that not only do we want the surrounding regions back, Nagorno-Karabakh itself, mountainous Karabakh itself, should be part of Azerbaijan, and we are going to give it some kind of autonomy, and Armenians and Azerbaijanis are living together in Moscow, in Georgia, so there won't be any problem. In a nutshell, it was an all-or-nothing type of diplomatic position.
Zero-sum game, yeah.
Zero-sum game. The Armenian side now. It was totally unexpected that Mr. Nikol Pashinyan, who had published a newspaper in the early, late 1990s, he was close to the first president of Armenia, Ter Pedrosyan. Then they fell out, and he started a march from city to city with a backpack, with military clothing, with a beard all sweaty. Nobody cared about that. And when he arrived in Yerevan, however, suddenly there were mass demonstrations, public protests, civic disobedience. And the gentleman who had already served twice as president, Serge Sarkisian, and had decided to change the constitution and to change the system into a parliamentary system with the center of power being the prime minister, he reneged on his promise and decided to be prime minister, so to stay in charge. It was a little trick, and the population didn't accept that. Those mass demonstrations led to the fact that Mr. Serge Sarkisian did the right thing. I mean, he decided not to shoot at the population or use the army, and he faced reality, and he gave power to Nikol Pashinyan. Nikol Pashinyan, from the very beginning, was faced with a massive disinformation campaign, basically what is called information warfare, probably organized by another country. A few of the themes that were used against him were the following one. Nikol Pashinyan is a puppet of George Soros, of international cosmopolitanism, or whatever you want to call it. Mr. Pashinyan and his acolytes, the young people who came to power, they want to destroy Armenian traditional values. Mm-hmm. For example, they want to adopt European conventions on the protection of women being battered by their husband, of children. Apparently, these were traditional Armenian values, and he was destroying them. And I can continue with those themes, but the key theme was that Nikol Pashinyan, having been close to Levon Derbedrosyan, the first president, was going to sell Karabakh, sell it out. This man, Nikol Pashinyan, was forced, of course, faced with the maximalism of Mr. Ilham Aliyev.
In Azerbaijan.
He reached the point where he stated very clearly that mountainous Karabakh is Armenian, period. And that has turned against him now. If you ask the Russians or the West, he shouldn't have said that, and so on. But he was forced by the situation to show that he is not going to sell Karabakh to anybody. In a nutshell, we had a total deadlock, Shahram. And President Aliyev, along with one of his advisors, Hikmet Hajiyev, have stated several times that when Pashinyan took power, they hoped that things would be easier with the Armenians. And they realized that far from selling Karabakh, you know, this guy was adopting a firm position. So there was no hope for progress. The third factor is the role played by Turkey. As you know, Mr. Erdogan is all over the place. Libya, northern Syria, northern Iraq, eastern Mediterranean. And it is absolutely clear now that he wants to expand Turkish influence in the South Caucasus via Azerbaijan. There will be a conference of Turkic nations very soon. He is proposing the formation of an army of Turan, the pan-Turkish dream metaphor of the early 20th century, of rebuilding Great Turan from the Sea of Japan to Norway, or Small Turan from Lake Baikal to Hungary. So besides his Islamist position, of which we are aware, he has fully adopted Turkish extreme nationalist rhetoric, and it is not surprising that the most nationalist party in Turkey now, which is more secular but rabidly nationalist and pan-Turkist, is his ally in Turkey. Mr. Erdogan is leading this war. It's not Mr. Aliyev. He is deciding what's going on, and he has no intention of stopping the war until substantial success takes place during it. So this is the third reason. And then there is a more general context, more secondary. Azerbaijan is not faced with a very brilliant prospect in the short term. Oil prices have fallen, oil consumption has fallen. Oil is a big part of Azerbaijani GDP. COVID is doing the same thing there than it's doing elsewhere. It's a very bad situation. There has been some agitation at the summit of the Azerbaijani state. The Minister of Foreign Affairs was dismissed. The Foreign Service was reshuffled. Somebody in the army was dismissed. There are indications that something is going on. And then there is the very propitious context. The timing, I believe, can be explained by the fact that there is a presidential election here, as you know, and nobody cares about, mountainous Karabakh or something. Russia has its hands full. Instability in Kyrgyzstan, instability in Belarus, revived conflict in the Ukraine. By the way, the Ukrainians are buying lots of Turkish drones and so on. So in the eastern Ukraine, things don't look good. Mr. Putin has also his problems over the Crimea and so on with the West, infringement on American elections and all those stories. So in terms of timing, it was the perfect moment to do it.
UC Berkeley historian Stefan Astorian speaking with Shahram Aghamir about the military conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan, two former Soviet Union republics in the Caucasus region. We'll hear more after a break. From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa.
Elite plundering the country's war. We have to point out that the present regime in Azerbaijan is an authoritarian regime, and there are many reports about this ruling elite plundering the country's wealth.
Yes.
There is the well-publicized case of Azerbaijan laundromat, as it's called,
yeah,
a complex money laundering operation and slush fund that had handled nearly $3 billion over a two-year period through shell companies. And this is a country that has been experiencing increasing income disparity. So it seems like fanning the flames of another war and trying to fuel nationalist sentiments, at least in the short term, may work in favor of Mr. Aliyev in Azerbaijan.
You are absolutely right. What is very interesting, you know, is that during his presidency, that is Ilham Aliyev's presidency, Armenophobia has been literally institutionalized in Azerbaijan. For example, in elementary school textbooks, middle school, high school, and so on, it is taught to kids. I am not telling you that there is no Armenian prejudice towards Azerbaijani or Turks, but this is not institutionalized in school textbooks and so on with idiotic stories for small kids. So Mr. Aliyev has prepared the ground. He is now dealing with a population, people born after 1991-92 in Azerbaijan, even 1988, have not met an Armenian in their lifetime. You have a whole generation and more of Azerbaijanis who have grown up in that environment of state-sponsored hatred and mythology, both historical and political, and he is benefiting from that. Today, during this war, you should know that even the opposition in Azerbaijan is enthusiastic about the war. Mr. Aliyev, if he is successful, right now he looks successful, but a war hasn't ended until it has ended. So even though things have not been going well at all for Mountainous Karabakh Armenians, and as I said, they are not far from Shusha or Shushi, they have already tried to capture Lachin. I mean, if they have a success on those two fronts, essentially the Karabakh problem is solved militarily.
Lachin, this is the corridor that actually connects the mountainous Nagorno-Karabakh to Armenian Republic.
Yes, that's the main corridor, the oldest one, to the south. And then later on, they were able to create another corridor to the north, which is endangered. Actually, it's forbidden to drive there for civilians and so on, because I believe it has been shelled. But if the corridor of Lachin falls, it's, you know, essentially most of Karabakh will be cut from Armenia for provisions, probably for ammunition or whatever they transport. And if Shushi falls, if you look at the geography of Karabakh, Shushi, it's very difficult to take it. It's on top of a very steep hill or a small mountain, not big mountain, but it's like on top of a rock. And that rock is basically overlooking Stepanakert, the capital of Karabakh. So if you capture Shushi, I mean, shooting at Stepanakert is like, I don't know, standing in front of my house and the car is parked in front of me and I don't know how to shoot, I shoot at the car, you know? It's, anybody can do it, basically. Well, that's what I am saying.
That's important.
So these are strategic positions. So far, they are doing well. The war continue like this, it's bingo for President Ilham Aliyev, and Mr. Erdogan will get the dividends out of it, the benefits out of it. He wants to have a seat at the table, to be part of the Minsk group co-chair, who have been negotiating this Karabakh issue, that is France, Russia, and the United States. And if he is successful, Mr. Erdogan, who already has huge influence in Georgia, because all the traffic of goods, the gas and oil from Azerbaijan goes to Georgia and then Turkey.
Yes.
Georgia is totally dependent now on Azerbaijan and Turkey. And it has allowed Turkish flights, Turkish trucks and so on to circulate, while it has prevented Russian military flights and so on to help Armenia over the past weeks. And it is severely constraining traffic from Russia to Armenia, a port of entry known as Lars, up in the mountains near South Ossetia. There has been backup of trucks over 6, 7, 8 kilometers there. So Georgia has very clearly taken sides. Mr. Putin is, I don't know what he is doing, he's being very patient, but if Karabakh falls, basically Turkey will have two-thirds of the Caucasus in his pocket, Azerbaijan certainly, and Georgia, and that will raise the issue of the supremacy of Russia in the South Caucasus.
So the stakes are high, and we'll definitely come back and talk about the regional actors, Russia, Turkey, Iran, and so forth and so on. What is the discourse vis-a-vis Nagorno-Karabakh conflict inside Armenia? You see that zero-sum mindset there too. Is it true? I mean, this is what we get from the media reports, but is that truly reflecting the mood of the majority of the people there? And the country also has had its own problems. before Mr. Pashinyan coming to power, 30 to 35% of people living below poverty line, there was official unemployment rate as high as 20 to 25%. There's also another major problem in Armenia that has to do with emigration out of Armenia. One of the three families emigrate, which means that Armenia has been losing 2% of the population annually. You also have the pandemic. The current government that is supposed to implement reforms into the political structure also look at this conflict through a different lens. Is the government using Nagorno-Karabakh conflict to rile up nationalist sentiments in Armenia, as the previous government did for many years?
No, these people who took power, let's say in the late spring, but essentially in the summer of 2018, they came to power with somewhat westernized ideas and values. And their agenda had little to do with inflaming the population with the Karabakh issue. That is absolutely certain. The Karabakh issue was used against them in that campaign, you know, of information warfare by the opposition, essentially by parties that have lost all credibility, the party of Serge Sarkisian, the Republicans, and other parties. These were essentially kleptocratic organizations.
The ones who were ruling Armenia for more than two decades.
Ruling and looting and pretending to be patriots, portraying themselves as the fierce defenders of Karabakh, and they would never return any territory. These were liberated territories around Karabakh and so on. The only problem is that when Mr. Pashinyan took power and got to know the state of the negotiations, he found out that these great patriots actually had agreed to the Madrid principles, the so-called Madrid principles of the Minsk group, that is the committee supervising supposedly the Karabakh problem. And it has three co-chairmen, as I said, US, France, Russia. The Madrid principles, subsequently modified in a few meetings, but their essence is the same. The idea is that Armenians are going to return five regions to Azerbaijan. That is everything except the two passes, Lachin and Kelbajar to the north. Then Azerbaijan and Turkey presumably are going to open their borders because Armenian is faced with closed borders on the side of Azerbaijan and Turkey. Then a decision will be made about Kelbajar, but guaranteed it is going to go to Azerbaijan. Then some kind of status has to be found for the Lachin corridor. Most likely some internationalized status with minimal presence of observers, a narrow corridor. And then in the final stage, at some point, at an undefined time, undefined participation, there would be a referendum about Mountainous Karabakh that would decide the status of Karabakh. The problem is that that comes at the very end of this step-by-step process, and who can exactly assure the Karabakh people that once all the territories have been returned, Azerbaijan will accept any kind of referendum? In addition, the participants to that referendum are not defined. So Azerbaijan can come up and say, yeah, we agreed to a referendum, but we mean a referendum of Azerbaijan and Karabakh people. Or it can claim that, you know, there were, let's say, 60,000 Azerbaijanis that were expelled from Karabakh. They and their descendants should be able to vote for that referendum. During all those years, those people have lied to the Armenians by pretending that they were delivering a package deal. And in fact, they had agreed to a step-by-step, very clearly process. They are denying that. They are saying it's package. But that's hot air. And these very same people, the second president, Kocharyan, and the third one, Serge Sarkisian, they were the ones who organized the palace coup against the first president, Levander Bedrosian, when he agreed to a step-by-step solution in the summer of 1997. You see how circumvoluted the whole thing.
Yes.
The name Nagorno-Karabakh consists of three words in three languages, the languages of the powers that have historically dominated the region. Nagorno means mountainous in Russian, as you mentioned. Kara or Kara means black in Turkish. And Bagh means garden in Persian. They use the word Bagh with the KH. It stems from the Russification of the word Bagh. Let's start talking about these regional players. You mentioned Turkey. You mentioned what its goal is. It's well known that Turkish military has been training Azerbaijan officers for decades. Just a month before the current clashes, Turkish military conducted large-scale military exercises in Azerbaijan. Turkey has also been selling to Azerbaijan rocket launchers and drones manufactured by a company owned by Turkish President Erdogan's son-in-law. According to some reports, Turkey may have also sent military drone operators to assist Azerbaijan in the current fighting. Clearly, they are involved in training and supplying arms. Should we expect to see presence of Turkish soldiers and officers?
What information is available now is this. As of about a week or 10 days ago, there were already, according to Russian intelligence, corroborated partly by other intelligence services, about 600 Turkish military personnel in Azerbaijan that went from the level of top generals to drone operators, F-16 pilots, some special forces, brigade level command system, and so on. Over the past, when was it, about 5 days ago, they decided to reinforce that presence with a special force regiment specialized in mountain fighting, to transfer that regiment from Kurdistan, actually, to Azerbaijan. Why? For a very simple reason, because when the Armenians have withdrawn or lost terrain, depending on people's interpretation, whether it's tactical withdrawal or they were crushed, the fact is that now, even to the south, the conflict has moved to hilly and mountainous and forested terrain. The territories they have lost, for example, Zangelan, Jabrail, Fuzuli, and so on, along the Araks River and the Iranian border, most of them were flatlands. Now the retreat towards Lachin and Shusha, it's getting mountainous. To the very north of Karabakh, Azerbaijanis haven't had much success. They have taken over a small piece of territory. But there you have mountains exceeding 3,000 meters in height. And it's not good for drones and so on. Bottom line, they are now transferring those forces specialized in mountain warfare to most likely guide Azerbaijani troops. They also transferred several batches of what used to be called elegantly during the first, it started, I believe, with the Afghan war and then the Iraq war, private contractors of the Islamic terrorist type from Syria and Libya.
Guardian had a report on that Turkey is recruiting these people from Syria and sending them to
Syria and also Libya. Again, Russian intelligence have literally named the groups. We have independent corroboration of that also by various organizations, corroboration by the French Secret Service and so on, even by the U.S. Just yesterday or the day before, the Russians blew up a training camp of people who were going to be sent to Karabakh. So these are the forces they are bringing. And what they did in a very crafty manner, they organized those military exercises, mostly in Nakhichevan, that is south of Yerevan, in July, and left behind a lot of armaments, including at least 4 to 6 documented F-16s that were transferred from the base of Genje, formerly Kirovabad, Elizabethpol under Russian rule. When that base was bombed by Karabakh troops about 3 weeks ago, they moved the airplanes to the base in Kabbalah, far away, where there used to be a strategic radar for nuclear war that has since then been decommissioned. Mr. Erdogan has also stated very clearly that he doesn't exclude more military intervention in this conflict. But up to now, all that we know is the 600 plus the regiment, plus some special forces, and documented number of Islamists at this point exceeds 2,500.
Stefan Asturian is the director of the Armenian Studies Program at University of California, Berkeley, and professor of the politics and history of the Caucasus and Armenia. He spoke with Shahram Aghamir. Join us next week to hear the second part of the interview. From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa.
That's it for us this week. Voices of the Middle East and North Africa is produced at KPFA Studios in Berkeley.
You can find us on Twitter at @Vomina_radio or listen to our past shows on iTunes or SoundCloud at Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. You can also reach us by email at vominaradio@gmail.com. Please join us next week for another edition of Voices of the Middle East and North Africa, and thank you for listening.
The Prison Radio Show is a twice-monthly news show on CKUT. The show seeks to confront the invisibility of prisons and prisoner struggles by focusing on the roots of incarceration, policing, and criminalization, and by challenging ideas about what prisons are and who ends up inside. We are dedicated to programming that is directly collaborative with people who are currently incarcerated. With that in mind, we would like to let you know that we have a phone line for prisoners and their outside supporters. In fact, we have two phone lines. You can call us Collect from Bordeaux Prison and Riviere de Prairie Prison by calling 514-876-3748. We also have a number for non-collect calls. That number is 438-337-8423. Feel free to call that number and leave a message for us with news to share on the show or an audio message for your loved ones inside.
To slow the spread of the virus, we need to press pause again. That's why once more, we need to stay home and avoid all non-essential travel. Gatherings are prohibited in red zones and are to be avoided in orange zones. And it's important to keep following the everyday health measures. Let's press pause again to curb the spread. Learn more at quebec.ca/coronavirus. Let's continue to protect ourselves properly. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
live, this step is up.
Radio with Widget and my man Pro V.
All the way live from University.
Damn, Montreal.
On CKUT.
Nobody do it better, dog.
90.3 FM.
Gone. CKUT and the place to be from the bottom to the TOP.
This program is uncut. It contains strong language and some adult situations. Discretion is advised.
All the way live radio, CKUT 90.3 FM, every single Wednesday from 3 to 5. This is Pro V. Happy New Year. Very sad news to find out the other day that MF Doom had passed away. So it's only right to pay homage to the man. And I'm not only going to play music from all of his albums, but going to be playing some pieces of interviews, whether it's him talking or artists speaking about him. But yeah, so it's going to be like a collage of things, interview track, or interlude track, however it may be. So you're going to hear tracks from all his solo albums, so Operation Doomsday, Food, Vaudeville Villain, Venomous Villain, The Mouse and the Mask, Mad Villain.